The CNBC app. Global market news in one place. Customizable sections and personalized alerts. Stocks tracking, interactive charts and market insights all in your hands. Stay connected. Stay informed. Download the CNBC app today.
Well, what a 24 hours of data we've had. Huge stats on both sides of the Pacific. Let's run through these stories in our headlines on Scorebox. So Chinese GDP tops forecast by a wide margin in the first quarter, but monthly data does come in soft, painting a mixed picture for the world's second largest economy. Over in the US, you've got stocks falling, you've got yield spiking, and the dollar hitting a five-month high. This after a red-hot retail sales print pushes expectations for a Fed rate cut even further out.
And Asian equities, well, they're suffering their heavy losses then, with 2% declines across the board. While the yen slides through 154 as traders watch and wait for potential policy intervention. And Tesla reportedly slashing 10% of its workforce as stiffer competition and softer demand send shares to a six-week low.
I think the last 20... Good morning to you.
Good morning.
How are you?
Yeah, good, thank you.
Good. I think the last 24 hours has kind of given flesh to something I was trying to explain when I was at the wall this time yesterday.
Yeah.
That geopolitics are stunningly important. When you've got two major global wars going on in the Middle East and indeed in the European continent,
yep.
These are very important, but they're very, very hard for markets to digest and quantify on a regular basis and try to say, okay, X should be this on the back of this. This bond should be this. This equity should be this. But when it comes to data, the markets are far better at extrapolating the information they want, that they think they can see, and saying markets should be this on the back of it. And I think the data from the United States last night was so important, this retail sales figure, because it was once again confirmation of something that traders don't want to see.
Yeah.
And that is a too strong economy. They want to see a strong economy, but they want a Goldilocks, and they don't want it so far, so strong that actually one of their basic props of the market, which is lower cost of money going forward, is taken away as well, because it means you have to rely on other things as well. You have to rely on momentum, and you have to rely on earnings as well. Those might still be there, but the former, the momentum, that is definitely wavering a little bit. The earnings season still looks potentially strong. And then on top of that, we've got data which you're going to be looking at in a few months.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the case, right? And on the back of that, like you were just saying, it's just changed so much where you see rate cuts coming, right? I mean, the market itself putting out that they're pricing in the 41% chance of Fed cutting rates in July. It was 50% before that data.
And that is a really important point. So something happened here, which I think is really worth just 2 seconds. And I know you're going to go to one in a moment and we're going to get back on track. But the market originally thought we were going to get 6 rate cuts this year. The Fed was steadfast saying in our SEP, our dot plot, you're only going to get 3. But now something else has happened. So the market was wrong and it kind of took that on the chin. It took it really well on the chin. But now, is it possible that, and the Fed has made a projection, not a promise. I keep saying it. The SEP is a projection, not a promise. But if the Fed is also wrong in its assumption of 3 cuts this year, that is now giving the market a bit of a, that is a great chart. Stay on that. Thank you very much indeed, Brittany and Will, for that. Because that chart shows that we were roughly at 5% October, then we went down aggressively to 3.7. Now we're moving up towards that 5% level again. We may not get there, but I just think it's fascinating what the market has absorbed has been very robust, and now they're beginning to wobble because maybe even the Fed's wrong. We've got to move on.
Certainly interesting. There's so many parts of the conversation that we're certainly going to continue to have, right? But it really has been an interesting picture across this Chinese GDP story, in fact, and that's the one we're really focusing on so early this morning. Chinese economy growing faster than expected then in this first quarter, with GDP rising by 5.3% then in the first 3 months of the year. That's compared, of course, to a year ago. It is above the 4.6% forecast by Reuters. Now, the country's National Bureau of Statistics did say that consumer inflation is recovering, but that the foundation of economic stability isn't yet solid. Beijing has set a growth target, of course, of around 5% for this year. But despite the GDP beat, other key Chinese data did miss expectations, and it was retail sales, which grew by 3.1% in the month of March, while industrial output then rose by 4.5%, both well below forecasts then as well. So that has been very, very interesting to look at. It's the data that has been entirely different across the board here. Lin Lin joining us for a little bit more here for an economy that has wanted some good news then. Lin, some good news on the GDP front, not necessarily on the retail sales front, which does ask the question as to what happens to consumer confidence.
Yeah, and that is certainly, Arabile, a really big question here. We've spoken to economists that say that when it comes to the way things are going in China, it's really two-track here, you could say. So let's focus first on the not-so-positive side of things, because along with the data that you've just set out there, we also got the March new home prices as well, and that was not good. It showed that prices were continuing to fall, and certainly that adds to the picture in terms of the property sector, that the momentum has still not swung back and that it remains a major, major drag on the economy, but not just the economy, of course, on the consumer sentiment here, consumer demand. We got the miss, as you say, on the retail sales. We also got a miss in terms of the CPI print as well as imports. They are all gauges when it comes to domestic demand. So certainly that is painting a picture here that perhaps more needs to be done. In terms of the biggest central stimulus policy that Beijing has to tackle this front at the moment is this trade-in program in terms of consumer appliances as well as upgrading equipment. And certainly we're waiting to see the flow-on effects of this program going forward. But when we look at perhaps maybe some of the more positive drivers, it is that the view among some economists at least is that the view is that China is really falling back on its old playbook here, which is focusing on its industrial output and the exports. But mind you, and perhaps this is why we're seeing a sell-off in terms of both the mainland as well as the Hong Kong markets. In terms of the March data, it was very bad on the trade front, and it was also a miss when it comes to industrial output, despite the fact that January and February, of course, we saw big, big beats. But certainly among some economists, the view is that that is where the growth is going to come, these new productive forces, right? This advanced technology that is then being sold out to the world. But certainly that is also a major cause of trade tensions between China and a number of countries. Back to you.
Thank you very much indeed. And that's superb coverage as ever, Lin. Thanks. Let's get to Shaolin Chen, head of international at Crane Shares. And Shaolin, lovely to see you today. Thank you for joining us. I look at the Chinese main stock markets, the Shenzhen down 2.8%, the Shanghai Composite down 1.4%, and the CSI Index down 1% as well. And I say to myself, well, look, the headline figure was great, 5.3%. But I ask you the question, and similar to Lin's coverage as well, what is it the markets didn't like about the data? Good day to you.
Thank you for having me on your program. I think the market reactions is sometimes to the data. If they all just accountable for the data, I think the equity market would be way off today's level for long mile. I think the market clearly reacts not only to the data, also to some potentially uncertainties on geopolitical risks, as you mentioned at the beginning of the program. Also, probably waiting for see what else the national team will do, what else the Chinese policymaker may do. Market has been doing the wait and see for quite a period of time. That's one. Second, I think if you take a step back to look at all these data, I agree, the 5.3 obviously beat market expectation, exceeded Chinese policymakers' set target of 5. But if you look at closely to see the results of, consumer, they wanted the consumer to recover. They wanted the consumer to lead the way out of the growth. And if you look at March credit data, households started borrowing, which is a great sign. I know it's only 1 month, because watch it very closely going forward, will they continue the trends or not? And also corporates started to borrow. This is kind of a leading indicator to say both will do something. Property market is setback. And I repeatedly said, I'm probably the only one have a big vocal voice here, is Chinese property market will not be the key driver of China's economic growth going forward, period, the end. The new force, like Lin mentioned, the clean technology, automotive, EV, those will be the sector. If you look at exports March, I clearly agree the March number was not great. January, February was great, but March wasn't great. But if you look at exports, clothing, toys was declined by 23%. Automobile, the automotive EV market, up by 28%. It clearly shows China is in a very important stage or phase of their own economic transitioning or shift towards high value chain items at the moment.
Charlene, good morning to you then. I mean, does that ease the pressure then on policymakers to ultimately not make as much stimulus as perhaps was on their shoulders before?
They have a lot of toolkits already deployed in the systems. Liquidity is way sufficient than needed. The liquidity stays in the system. That's why seeing liquidity flow through down to the sector's household is very important. That's one. Second, I don't think they will stop here. They have made it very clear last month to say we're going to issue 1 trillion RMB of ultra long dated bonds to start with. They made it very clear to start with. They have a lot of leeway to do. Clearly, they're waiting for a bit, wait and see how their counterpart will turn out to be in terms of election and also risk decision. That will impact their decision somehow. It's linked anyway. In that way, I do not think they will stop. I actually had a pleasure to meet with the Chinese regulator about a month ago. They posed to us, is how can we help? I made it very clear, at least from my feedback to them, was make it very communicative, make it very transparent. So far, all the regulations issued by Chinese regulator from CSRC, namely, are very clear. They are trying to help the market, stabilize the market, make sure the market has good companies to come forward in terms of IPO, so on and so forth, and stay very transparent with why they're doing so.
Yeah. I mean, China purchases a lot of commodities. And earlier you were just speaking about the new sort of sectors that will ultimately be leading China forward with regards to its growth path then as well. But China was a purchaser of a lot of commodities, particularly for that construction basis then as well. Is the fact that China will no longer be purchasing that much by way of commodities fully understood in the market and a part of the growth picture moving forward?
Commodity needs for real estate particularly will slow down. The new home sales price fall slightly, start to see stabilization of the falling. Let me say that right. It starts, stabilizing but still falling. Those kind of related commodity in terms of buying a new home appliance and then use for building a new building, those will continue to slow down and will not return to the peak level. That's S1. But China has introduced this new problem called trading. So you can bring any old cars or old home appliances to come forward and trade for a new one. And then in some ways, they will subsidize you a bit of a more, a bit of the differences. And you would say, well, how much will that can generate in terms of returns? China today roughly estimates was having 420 million cars. On average, it's 5.5 years lifetime. In China, there's a rule and regulation to say you cannot drive your car for certain cars, or every car is different, between 8.5 to 10 years. So some of the cars literally 2 years or less than 8 years, 8 to 10 years of life, then you can't drive them on the road anymore. So it's really 2.5 years, some of the cars, before they reach their lifetime. So if the policy come forward to say, come and trade in with the new EV, or come and trade in with the new car, and we charge you very little between the differences, I believe people will move forward for those kind of offers on the table. And I think in terms of commodity, they still continue to need for those kind of needs in the new product force. China will do some infrastructure. It's not completely scratch. They will do infrastructure, but in the power grid, in the new infrastructure, per se, the green infrastructure to facilitate them to achieve the carbon goal.
We are going to leave it there. Thank you so much indeed for your instant reaction to the Chinese data. Lovely to see you again. Xiaolin Chen, who is head of international at Crane Shares. And for more on China's headline GDP beat, but a more nuanced picture underneath the hood, and why that might make the government perhaps more comfortable with its current policy stance, check out CNBC.com. Well, I think this data was huge last night. The US retail sales came in way above expectations in March, jumping 0.7% on the month, more than double the uptick the Dow had forecast. Monthly figures in February were also revised higher to 0.9% from 0.6%. Michael Feroli is chief US economist at JP Morgan and said the data hasn't yet changed the lender's house view on when the Fed will begin to cut rates.
Right now, we still have them cutting in July, but I think if it's going to be tough, if they don't get a cutoff by then, it may have to wait until December, given I don't think they want to start a cutting cycle before this election. So, you know, still a lot of data to go between now and then. The latest data clearly would not suggest easing, but we'll have to see what we get going forward.
Let me just take a step back. Isn't that extraordinary when the might of JP Morgan is saying, yeah, well, we still think July is in play, but they look a bit nervous about it, don't they? I mean, July in play. Do you remember when you guys thought March was in play? Not so long ago. San Francisco Fed President Mary Daly has stuck to her line that there isn't any rush to cut rates. Well, I mean, the retail sales just confirmed that, didn't they? Daly, who has a vote on policy this year, so she's absolutely pivotal, told an event at Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research that policy is in a good place and that the worst thing that policymakers could do here was to act urgently when there isn't any urgency. And isn't that actually amazing? That's the thing that the markets are having to digest, that underlying the consumer looks strong. They've got their jobs. The GDP indicators are going up. Atlanta Fed nowcast is going up as well. Why would you cut rates when things look so good? Yeah. That's the problem for the market, who had a bit of a wobbly last night.
They certainly did, Steve, right? I mean, the S&P 500 is the biggest loser then across the board yesterday, more than 1 point, or rather the S&P as well as the NASDAQ. And again, it was those tech shares that got a little bit of a hit as well significantly yesterday. I mean, if I just run through some of them, Microsoft, Apple, as well as Meta and Nvidia, those are 2%, give or take some change. Tesla falling over 5.5% then in the day's trading. That's another issue on its own, of course, having said that they're going to cut around 10% of their workforce. So that's one we'll take a look at. But the Dow Jones Industrial, remember 40,000? Well, they were there actually just at the beginning of this month. They've lost 5% when it comes to the Dow Jones Industrial itself. That's more than 2,000 points. And we're only at the midway point then of this month. So significant moves is certainly what you have seen. We also are in this earnings season, right? So the banks have also been ones to really have focused on, the likes of Goldman Sachs then coming out with earnings. So a slightly better picture than what we saw out of Friday then. And really the question mark had been whether NIMs had peaked ultimately for a lot of the lenders. Then still Citigroup on the downward following its numbers having come out just last week. Where are we on the Treasury front though? Well, that flight towards safety, that's still in play somewhat. But the question mark had been following the retail sales figures that perhaps it would take a little bit more work for the Fed to bring down inflation before it begins to cut those interest rates. So you're seeing the 10-year actually hit 4.61. Now, the last time we were at 4.6 for the 10-year Treasury note, you had seen the S&P at 4,600 as well. Right now, we're past 5,000 points still for that note. So just thought that would be interesting to note. We even saw the 2-year actually hit 5% again then yesterday. It has now just come off that mark. On to the Asian trading market then. Well, Asian stocks downward today following that U.S. slide that we saw yesterday, taking a bit of that dip following on from what you saw there. The Shanghai Composite, a big 1.2% decline, but a bigger decline then as well for the Nikkei 225 out of Japan, 1.8% lower on that front. Again, some of the tech stocks being key proponents to that. Of course, you do have the GDP figure having come out as well out of China, 5.3%, much higher than the market had anticipated, which was 4.6% as well there. We are still looking out for Japan's release of trade data as well as inflation numbers. That's happening on Wednesday and Friday. Of course, we have to take a look at the yen, don't we? And this is pretty much where we are, having raced past 154 pretty much yesterday after having seen those retail sales figures out of the US, plus the anticipation then, of course, of where you're going to see policy intervention. Just to really note as well that the finance minister out of Japan also just really noting again then saying that they are watching closely, that is, the currency moves and will provide a thorough response as needed. So we're still on intervention watch when it comes to dollar yen so far in this geopolitical state that we're currently facing as well. Opening calls, this is pretty much where we are for Europe then. Yesterday's trade then was a little bit subdued. The energy shares were down on the back of the oil prices going a little bit weaker as well yesterday. Of course, the geopolitical tensions out of the Middle East being quite key to a lot of that. We look like we could be headed for a negative start for today's trade, Steve.
Yeah, but when will the BOJ and the MOF in Japan go from jawboning to actual action? And then will the markets try and take them on? I think that's a huge debate we need to have. Also, coming up on the show, Tesla reportedly prepares to cut more than 10% of its workforce as sales slump. We'll have the details later this hour. Also, Ericsson actually beat analyst expectations, but did warn of further declines in the RAND market. We'll break down the numbers with the CEO, Börje Ekholm. Don't miss that interview. We'll do that in 25 minutes' time for you as well. And Jeremy Hunt, UK Chancellor of the Exchequer, heads to the IMF, insisting the UK economy is on the up. We'll discuss the health of the nation's economy with Gareth Davis, Exchequer Secretary to the UK Treasury, in a first on CNBC interview that is coming up in 1 hour and 10 minutes' time.
Ambition to me is about doing better.
I think ambition creates a pathway.
The best advice I can give someone starting off a career is don't have a career, have lots of careers, try loads of different things.
Talk to people and put your ambition out there.
I don't feel that I've hit peak ambition because it's a learning journey.
CNBC is where ambition meets opportunity. What does living ambitiously mean to you? Hear it from our CNBC anchors, reporters and global business leaders on CNBC.com.
Look at this. This is fascinating. Brent crude trading 90.67 back up to where it was before its declines yesterday on the back of the data rather than, I think, geopolitics. Now, there's a lot going on and we're all just waiting to see what the Israelis do next. But the Iraqi Prime Minister, Mohammed Shia al-Sudani, has urged restraint in the Middle East. Speaking in Washington at the start of a meeting with the US President Joe Biden, Sudani said he encouraged all efforts to prevent the conflict from escalating further. Meanwhile, Mr. Biden said he is committed to Israel's security. Well, the Israeli response to the attack from Iran could reportedly be imminent, but the US expects it will be limited in scope. That's according to NBC News, which cited sources familiar with the matter. US officials have reportedly not been briefed on Israel's decision making. Meanwhile, both the US and its European allies have stepped up efforts to prevent further escalation in the region. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken and the UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said the allies were preparing a diplomatic response, which could include further sanctions on Tehran. The French President Emmanuel Macron also said the international community should do everything it can to, quote, avoid flare-ups. Well, Israel's military chief warned the country had no choice but to respond.
We are closely assessing the situation. We remain at our highest level of readiness. Iran will face the consequences for its actions. We will choose our response accordingly. The IDF remains ready to counter any threat from Iran and its terror proxies as we continue our mission to defend the state of Israel.
Dan, in this terrible war, the world awaits Israel's response. In the region, tensions must be heightened.
Indeed, Steve. And as you just heard there, an Israeli official has told NBC News that a response may be imminent. We also know that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's war cabinet has been meeting in the last few hours to weigh its own options in response to Iran's attack on Saturday. And of course, President Joe Biden has urged the Prime Minister to not carry out new strikes on Iran and has also made it clear that Washington will not join any Israeli counterattack. I spoke with Israel's former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert this morning on Capital Connection. He says the success of Israel's response on Saturday ultimately buys it more time to consider its next move. Listen.
They declared war on Israel. There is no question about it. They declared war Saturday night. And it may have become something much more dramatic. But as a result of the most impressive response by the alliance of Israel, the United States, and Britain, France, and some Arab countries, turned out to be defeat to the Iranians. This was a humiliating defeat to the Iranians. They shot more than 300 UAVs, cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, and they were all intercepted. It was incredible. I must say it is an historical day in terms of the military performance. But the outcome provides Israel with, I think, time to be able to think in a cool head before we retaliate.
So there are several options that Israel could take in response. We've been speaking with experts and analysts over the last few days to try and gauge exactly what could happen next here. In the most severe scenario, Israel could potentially target Iran's nuclear program or even its oil facilities. That would be a major escalation for the region and for global markets. In another scenario, we could perhaps see Israel attempting to target Iran's most powerful proxy, which is Hezbollah, but that would also mark a major escalation that Israel and its allies would likely want to avoid at this point. You also have to remember that Iran has ultimately deemed its operation concluded, and we have seen world leaders around the region and elsewhere calling for restraint. So the ball is really in Israel's court right now, and what it does next will be material for risk assets, safe havens, and of course regional stability as well.
Thank you for listening to Squawk Box Europe Express.
For more market moving news, you can head to cnbc.com or join us again on the show with me, Steve Sedgwick, and Karen Cho, weekdays on CNBC.